So imagine being just so utterly terrified of losing your grip on power that you flee your own country in a complete panic, just taking refuge in some hotel in Rome, completely convinced your reign is permanently over.
Which is a terrifying thought for a monarch.
Exactly. But then, just 4 days later, you aren't just back on your throne. I mean, an American intelligence director has physically escorted you onto a plane, flown you back home, and basically handed you absolute unchecked power over an entire nation.
It honestly sounds like the plot of some over-the-top political thriller, you know? But that sequence of events is actually a matter of historical record.
Yeah, it really is. Well, welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are bringing you right into the center of, well, four frantic days that completely redefined the 20th century.
August 15th through the 19th, 1953.
Right. And our mission today is to sift through this really fascinating dossier we have of declassified U.S. records, scholarly analysis, historical timelines, and dissect this whole Iranian crisis. We are going to figure out exactly how a covert operation designed to overthrow Iran's democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh initially collapsed in just spectacular fashion.
Only to be resurrected through, honestly, an improvised campaign of sheer chaos.
Yeah. But to really understand what happened during those 4 days, we have to look just briefly at the economic strangulation leading up to them, right?
Yeah, you have to set the stage. The prime target of this operation, Prime Minister Mossadegh, had recently made this monumentally controversial move. He nationalized Iran's oil industry.
Right, which was a huge dump.
Massive. Prior to that, the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which is a huge British monopoly, they controlled virtually the entire infrastructure of Iranian oil,
Right.
and they were extracting incredible wealth, all while paying Iran, honestly, a relative pittance.
So when Mossadegh nationalized that industry to keep the profits inside Iran, I mean, the British government didn't just, write a stern letter.
Oh, no, not at all.
They launched a crippling global boycott of Iranian oil. They froze Iranian assets. I mean, they essentially blockaded the ports.
Yeah, it was total economic warfare.
Right. So by August 1953, the Iranian economy was just in free fall, and Mossadegh's political coalition was really fracturing under this intense financial pressure.
Which, as you can guess, created the perfect opening for foreign intervention. This is where the CIA steps in with Operation TPAJX.
Right.
And they're working alongside British intelligence. Their operation was called Operation Boot. But the thing is, they didn't want to just, roll military forces into Tehran and declare a takeover.
Too messy.
Exactly. They wanted this coup to look legal. They needed it to have a veneer of constitutional legitimacy.
Okay, let's unpack this. The entire operational plan hinges on Iran's monarch.
Yeah.
The young and, as the sources say, notoriously insecure Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. So the intelligence agencies spend weeks pressuring him to sign these royal decrees, known as farmans. And the strategy is for the Shah to use these decrees to officially dismiss Mossadegh from power.
And then replace him with a pro-Western military officer, General Fazlollah Zahedi.
Right. So August 15th arrives, and this is the moment the plan is supposed to execute cleanly.
Yep. The Shah finally signs the paperwork. The trap is set.
Okay.
So this officer, General Nasiri, he's dispatched to Mossadegh's residence late at night to deliver the dismissal decree in person. And up to this very second, the CIA and MI6, they completely believe they're running a tightly controlled surgical operation.
But the reality, however, is just a complete short circuit.
Oh, totally.
Because Mossadegh has a massive network of loyalists, and he's actually already been tipped off that a move against him is imminent.
Yeah, he knew they were coming.
Right. So when General Nasiri arrives at his door brandishing this royal decree, Mossadegh doesn't step down. He simply has his guards arrest the messenger on the spot.
It is a stunning reversal. I mean, the officer sent to carry out the coup is literally thrown into jail by the target of the coup.
It's like a bank attempting to serve an eviction notice, but the tenant just handcuffs the landlord to the radiator and locks the door.
That is exactly what it was like. And the sheer audacity of Mossadegh's countermove completely derails the intelligence plot before it even gets off the ground.
Wow.
So the immediate fallout is a total operational collapse. And the reaction of the Shah gives you a very clear picture of his mindset at the time. When he hears that Mossadegh arrested his messenger, the Shah panics.
Just completely loses it.
Yeah, he genuinely believes that by participating in this plot, he has just forfeited his life, let alone his throne. So he boards a private plane and flees the country immediately.
First heading to Baghdad, right?
Right, and then flying on to Rome.
So the monarch is sitting in Italy, reading news reports and assuming Mossadegh has permanently won. And back in Washington and London, I mean, the assessment from headquarters is essentially identical. Standard procedure for a blown covert action is to, you know, burn your documents, cut your losses, and get your agents out of the country before they end up in front of a firing squad.
Exactly. So they send orders to shut it down.
Right. And that is where the story should logically end. A failed royal dismissal, a monarch in exile, and a prime minister surviving a foreign plot.
But it doesn't.
No. The reason it doesn't end there comes down to one specific CIA officer stationed on the ground in Tehran, Kermit Roosevelt Jr.
The grandson of Theodore Roosevelt, actually.
Yes, and the sources show Roosevelt taking this massive unauthorized risk.
Mm-hmm.
While his bosses are drafting postmortems, Roosevelt just ignores the failure.
He goes rogue.
He does. He decides to improvise a radical backup plan. Because if a quiet, top-down, legalistic dismissal wouldn't work, well, he was going to create a bottom-up illusion of a country just tearing itself apart.
What's fascinating here is the mechanism he used to do that. Because it relied almost entirely on deploying massive sums of CIA cash into very specific Iranian networks.
Right, the dossier goes into this.
Yeah, it details how Roosevelt completely bypassed traditional political channels and went straight into the bazaars and the traditional Persian gymnasiums known as Zirkana.
Okay, right, the Zirkana.
Hmm.
Because these gymnasiums were hubs for weightlifters, wrestlers, martial artists.
Mm-hmm.
But in the political context of 1953, they also functioned as networks for organized street muscle.
Exactly. So Roosevelt's team funnels money to local mobsters, figures with colorful names. Like there's one called Shaban the Brainless.
Wow.
And they essentially acted as contractors. They rented out massive crowds. The whole goal was to manufacture a visceral sense of lawlessness.
Right.
So they paid local newspapers to suddenly print virulent anti-government propaganda. They basically wanted the average citizen in Tehran to look out their window and feel like society was physically collapsing under Mossadegh's leadership.
Okay, here is where I have to push back a bit, or at least bring up a detail from our sources that initially threw me completely off balance.
Oh, the provocateurs.
Yes. Wait, yeah. The records state that as part of this rented chaos, the CIA heavily funded provocateurs to pose as communists.
Right.
They paid gangs to run through the streets, smash shop windows, attack mosques, all while shouting pro-Soviet slogans.
Yeah, it sounds counterintuitive.
Right, because if the entire underlying Western justification for orchestrating this coup in the first place was to stop the spread of communism in the Middle East, why are they using taxpayer money to literally fund communist riots?
So you have to look at the domestic pressure points in Iran to understand the cynical brilliance of that tactic. Prime Minister Mossadegh's political base, the National Front, it was largely secular.
Okay.
But to maintain a governing majority, he relied on a very fragile alliance with Iran's powerful, conservative, religious clerics.
Oh, and those religious leaders viewed the atheistic, pro-Soviet Iranian Communist Party, the Tudor Party, as an absolute existential threat to Islam and traditional society.
Exactly. And British and American intelligence analysts, they privately doubted there was any immediate genuine threat of a Soviet takeover in Iran.
They knew it wasn't real.
Right. But they knew the fear of a takeover was a potent weapon. Historians call this utilizing the bogey of communism. And Roosevelt weaponized that bogeyman perfectly.
Wow.
By paying thugs to vandalize mosques while waving communist flags and claiming they were taking over the country in Mossadegh's name, the CIA manufactured the exact nightmare the clerics feared most.
It's just a deeply manipulative psychological operation. I mean, they are artificially linking the prime minister to this terrifying threat in order to shatter his political coalition.
And it was incredibly effective. The staged riots terrified the conservative clerics, driving a permanent wedge between them and Mossadegh.
It pushed those religious factions toward the perceived stability of the military and the monarchy.
Yes. Roosevelt essentially created a synthetic crisis to force a very real political realignment.
Okay, but renting a mob and smashing windows, that only creates noise. How do you escalate from a fake communist riot to actual military tanks rolling through the Capitol?
Right. That brings us to August 19th.
The violently dramatic climax of these 4 days.
Yeah, the manufactured paranoia of the preceding days served as the accelerant here. So by the morning of August 19, the orchestrated pro-Shah crowds were marching again. But the crucial shift was the military's reaction.
How so?
Well, throughout this crisis, a lot of Iranian army officers had been sitting on the fence just waiting to see which side had the momentum. The chaos in the streets provided the cover they needed. Royalist army units, sensing that Mossadegh's support was crumbling, they actively joined the rented crowds.
And we really need to ground this in the factual reality of what happened next without sensationalizing it. Because this wasn't a game of political chess.
No, not at all.
It was a brutal, bloody street battle. The crowds, now backed by literal military tanks and heavily armed soldiers, marched directly on Prime Minister Mossadegh's residence.
The human stakes of August 19 are sobering. Mossadegh still had loyalist forces and personal guards who refused to back down. So they engaged in intense, hours-long firefights with the royalist military units.
And the declassified sources indicate that roughly 200 to 300 people were killed in the streets of Tehran that day.
Yeah, people were fighting and dying block by block.
Eventually, the sheer firepower of the royalist tanks overwhelmed the defenders. Mossadegh's house was practically reduced to rubble, and the prime minister was forced to surrender.
The elected government officially fell. General Zahedi stepped in as the new prime minister.
And that leads to an almost surreal epilogue that perfectly encapsulates the power dynamic of the entire operation.
The flight back from Rome?
Yes. The Shah has been sitting in his Italian hotel, entirely removed from the violence, still believing his reign is over. And he gets a telegram that the coup has succeeded.
Right.
And he doesn't just book a commercial flight home. He flies back to Tehran on a plane accompanied by Alan Dulles.
The director of the CIA.
Exactly.
It is a profound historical image. I mean, the exiled autocrat physically escorted back to his throne by the chief architect of American intelligence. The monarchy is fully restored, and Mossadegh is subsequently tried for treason in a military court and spends the rest of his life under house arrest.
So what does this all mean for us today? We have a clear timeline of the 4 days, right? The failed legal decrees, the bags of CIA cash, the manufactured street violence, and the ultimate military clash.
Yes.
But as we review the scholarly analysis in this dossier, we find a massive historical debate sitting right at the center of how we should interpret these events.
Yeah.
And just a reminder for you listening, we're not taking sides here, just laying out what the sources and historians argue.
Right. So for decades, the dominant narrative in the West was heavily shaped by Kermit Roosevelt's own memoirs. He really loved to boast about his exploits, which fueled what historians call the mastermind myth.
Okay, the mastermind myth.
This is the idea that the CIA were these all-powerful, omniscient puppeteers who just walked into a sovereign nation, pulled all the strings, and single-handedly overthrew a government.
And looking at the sheer volume of cash Roosevelt threw around and the meticulously planned psychological operations we just discussed, it's very easy to see why that narrative took hold. They bought the mobs, they bought the newspapers, they set the timeline.
Yet many modern historians fundamentally challenge that view. There is a robust counterargument in our sources known as the collapse narrative, which is championed by scholars like Dariush Bandor.
And what do they argue?
They argue that the tidy CIA mastermind story is actually a form of Western arrogance because it completely strips the Iranian people of their own political agency.
Right. So instead of a match hitting a pool of gasoline, think of Mossadegh's political coalition like a very unstable Jenga tower.
That's a great way to put it.
The British oil embargo, the ensuing economic devastation, and Mossadegh's own alienating domestic policies had already pulled out almost all the supporting blocks.
Exactly. The collapse narrative points out that powerful domestic actors like the influential cleric Ayatollah Kashani, major factions of the Iranian military, and conservative politicians, they were already actively plotting against Mossadegh, completely independent of the CIA.
Wow. Okay.
So in this view, Kermit Roosevelt didn't build the Jenga tower, and he didn't weaken its foundation. He just walked up and flicked the final top block. The internal fractures within Iran are what actually brought the government down.
And there is a brilliant, highly specific piece of evidence from the declassified files that supports this messier, less orchestrated view of the coup.
Yes, the cable.
It is a secure cable sent by Kermit Roosevelt himself to Washington on the very morning of August 19.
The August 19 cable is a crucial piece of the puzzle. When you read Roosevelt's live reporting to headquarters, the text strongly indicates that he was genuinely surprised by the massive scale and momentum of the events unfolding in the streets.
Right, the very events he later claimed to have flawlessly engineered from start to finish.
Exactly.
In the moment, he seemed shocked by how quickly the military and the crowds moved. It heavily implies that while the CIA absolutely tried to manufacture a movement, a very real, very uncontrollable Iranian domestic uprising basically hijacked the momentum and took over the streets.
And as guides to these historical records, our role isn't to declare a definitive winner between these two schools of thought, but engaging with both perspectives is vital.
Absolutely.
Focusing entirely on CIA cash ignores the massive pre-existing fault lines in Iranian society. Conversely, pretending the CIA's psychological warfare didn't act as the fatal catalyst, well, that ignores the reality of the covert operation.
Right. The truth lies in the messy collision of foreign interference and severe domestic instability.
Exactly.
So to synthesize this deep dive for you over just 4 days in August 1953, an elaborate intelligence plot failed at the first hurdle.
Totally collapsed.
Right, and it was salvaged by an American operative distributing massive amounts of cash to local mobsters, weaponizing fake communist threats to terrify religious leaders, and ultimately sparking a violent military clash that left hundreds dead and ended Iran's democratic experiment.
And the reason understanding these 4 days is so crucial is that August 19th, 1953, it established a geopolitical template that continues to shape our world.
How so?
Well, immediately following the coup, the British oil monopoly was dismantled, but it was replaced by a massive consortium of Western oil companies, which fundamentally altered global energy markets for the next several decades.
Furthermore, it established a deeply consequential dynamic in U.S.-Iran relations. Mm. I mean, the West had successfully propped up a friendly autocrat.
Right.
And to ensure he stayed in power, the CIA and Israeli intelligence helped the Shah establish SAVAK, which was a notoriously brutal secret police force designed to ruthlessly crush any domestic dissent.
And that suppression of legitimate political opposition over the next quarter century essentially guaranteed that when the backlash finally came, it wouldn't be democratic.
It would be radical.
Exactly, culminating in the 1979 Islamic Revolution and the ensuing hostage crisis. The decisions made during those 4 days in August cascaded into the enmity that defines the region today.
Which brings me to a final lingering thought I want you to mull over as we close. Think back to that cinematic image of the Shah's return.
Him on the plane with Dulles.
Yes. Consider the deep psychological impact on a ruler who knows, intimately, that he did not win his throne back through the overwhelming love or spontaneous uprising of his people.
No, he knows he panicked.
Right. He knows he fled, and he knows he had to be physically flown back to his own palace by a foreign intelligence director.
It breeds a profound hidden insecurity at the very core of his leadership.
Exactly. How does that secret insecurity, that glaring knowledge that you owe your crown entirely to a CIA operation, shape the way an autocrat chooses to rule for the next 26 years? How heavily do you lean on a brutal secret police force when you've seen exactly how easily a government can be toppled? Sometimes, when the dominoes don't fall the way you planned, the chaotic force you use to push them down leaves scars that outlast everyone involved.